Have you ever visited the Louvre Museum in Paris? Maybe you came away a bit overwhelmed and exhausted by it all, like I did on my first trip. The massive collection of 500,000 paintings, statues, and other works of art spreads out over the largest museum in the world, and to see it, it requires a game plan for how you're going to prioritize what to see in its more than 400 rooms. Like me, Elaine Chelino doesn't remember much from her first visit, but living in Paris since 2002, she's had countless hours to lean into its magnitude and to learn about how it operates by talking with curators, guards, and fellow museum goers. Elaine brings her journalist's perspective for making sense of it all in her latest book. It's called Adventures in the Louvre: How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. Elaine, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Rick, as always.
You know, of all the museums in the world, the Louvre really is unique, isn't it? How is it special?
How is it special? It's special because it's so big and it's so filled with so many extraordinary works of art. It started not as a museum, but as a fortress, and then it became a palace, and only then did it become a museum, which is why it's so mixed up, or ungapachka, as you might say. And that makes it really, really hard to deconstruct and to follow and to master.
You know, if you were able to fly over it and you look down at the footprint of the Louvre, you do see a square section at one end, and then it grows in lengths over the reigns of different kings and so on through the ages until it's a giant horseshoe. Let's pretend we're two birds flying over the Louvre. Give us a little tour of what we would see looking down.
Well, I think it kind of looks like a Tetris. And in the middle of this Tetris is the pyramid. And already you're confused because it already makes no sense. You don't know where to go in. You know, how am I going to not only get into this place, but master this place, especially if I come with a spouse and my two kids or three kids? And it's just so, so big. I mean, it's...
But let's go way before tourism, Elaine. And
yes.
You'll find the court, what is it called? The cour carré, the old courtyard?
The cour carré. The square courtyard.
I've been underground from there, and you can see the giant walls, the circular turrets that fortified a fort. In
12th century.
So that's 800 years ago. And you can see these ramparts that are now underground because Paris has risen over the centuries. But that was the core. And before there was even a notion of a museum, before most of this art was even done, it was an important building. And then it grew and grew and grew to be, I think at one time, the biggest building in the world.
That's right.
How did that happen? Take us in a chronology just of the architecture.
Well, it was king after king. You know, it started with Philippe Augustus, who was a warrior, and he wanted to build a fortress, and he builds this fortress and goes off to the Crusades. It takes him 20 years to build the basis of the Louvre. And then over the centuries, various kings and queens put their marker on it. It's kind of like interior decoration or renovation, you know, not by committee, but by all these individuals with big egos.
By royal ego.
I was going to say royal ego.
You walk through and you see the banners of the different kings. And I just love that. If you can see the letters entwined, you go, oh, that's Louis the so-and-so or Napoleon or whatever. And it goes century after century after century until now. You walk for blocks and you're still walking along the same building, aren't you?
Well, if you walked through every room, it would give you 9 miles of exercise. It would take about 18,000 steps. So if you're really, really an exercise maniac, just walk through every room of the Louvre.
You know, I've got a photograph, Elaine, of me laying on the floor of the Louvre as the exhausted tourist. I call it the victim of the Louvre. And it was quite difficult to get that photograph because every time I laid down looking like I had passed out, people would gather around me and think, oh, can I help you? No, just relax. I'm just getting a stupid photograph to teach people how big the Grand Gallery, the longest gallery. I think it's a quarter mile long, this one gallery.
But let me remind you, Rick, that you were one of the first people I interviewed when I started this project because I wanted to know how you master the Louvre with normal people. Because my book is a book for normal people. And, you know, how do you make everyone feel like an insider without doing all the homework? And so you told me early on, you said, Elaine, my mother told me I had to go to the Louvre. So I dutifully went to the Louvre. But it's it's not easy. It's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard work, and you really have to invest. Yeah. It's like going to battle.
Okay, well, that's the thing, because there's a lot of buildings that people end up hating, and one of them is the Louvre. If they don't know how to approach it, the subtitle of your book is How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. So what is your trick? How do we not leave it exhausted and frustrated, but leave it wanting to go back and having had a lovely experience? What's the trick for somebody who enjoys the Louvre?
Well, I have one basic rule. Never go to the Louvre on an empty stomach or with a full bladder. Because you think you're going to go, oh, I'll just go into the Louvre and I'll grab a little sandwich, or I'll go to the toilet in the Louvre. You won't. You'll already be frustrated the minute you go in. So what you have to do is you have to prepare yourself. You go to this little cafe next to the Louvre and you sit down and you pretend you're French and you have a coffee and a croissant and you go to the toilet in the basement and you get yourself all caffeinated and ready for action. And if you do that, you'll be a lot happier.
You know, when we think of the lay of the land, it is a little overwhelming. And the point you make is, typical tourist just stampedes in and wants to see all the most famous pieces of art. There's 8 or 10 pieces that everybody wants to see.
Sure.
But it is a museum you can go back for the rest of your life. You wrote, its grand galleries, obscure wings, tricky labyrinths, illogical corridors, and narrow staircases can overwhelm even the most passionate art lovers. But you also fell in love with it. Where is some place in the Louvre that is really special to you, other than jockeying for a spot in front of the Mona Lisa to get your selfie, you know?
Well, in my past life, I spent a lot of time in Iran, traveling through Iran. You know, I covered the Iranian Revolution. And what I discovered once at Persepolis was the gift shop. And in the gift shop were postcards from the Louvre, because the Louvre has some of the most extraordinary colored friezes of what should have been at Persepolis. Wow. And I can go into that room and imagine what it was like being in Iran. And no one goes into those rooms. And it's fun going into a room of the Louvre and feeling as if you own it, because you are alone with a work of art and away from the crowds and crowds that are obsessed by the Mona Lisa and all of the famous big oversized French paintings, and just relax.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're immersing ourselves in the Louvre right now with author Elaine Sciolino. Elaine is a contributing writer and a former Paris bureau chief for the New York Times. She's written several books about Paris, and her latest is called Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. You can find more about Elaine's work at her website. It's elainesciolino.com, and that's spelled S-C-I-O-L-I-N-O. And you'll find previous interviews we've done together in our radio archives. Elaine, when we think of the Louvre, I think of it as a triumph of the people, the commoners. In fact, you even quoted me in your book. I just stumbled onto that. I was preparing for our interview, and I wrote something. It's the triumph of the people. The commoners have gone wild. It's a celebration of life. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, you said it, and you told it to me, and it helped me in my research. It's the people's museum. The Louvre was created because of the French Revolution, you know, in 1793, and it was open to all.
Yeah, to give some people that context, it is kind of a historical thing. You cut off the head of the king and the queen, and you just inherit the biggest palace in the world and the greatest art collection in the world. And it's a people's revolution after all. What are you going to do? Hang the royal collection in the palace, open up the palace for the people, and voila, you've got the Louvre. Isn't that kind of what the Louvre's all about?
100%. And also put in all of the art that you stole from all the churches and from the nobility who either fled or who were decapitated were in the French Revolution.
So when people complain about all of the unwashed masses, you know, stampeding through, I kind of look at it as a triumph of democracy, because it used to be this elite place where just the nobles and the royalty were, and the masses of the people would never be able to enjoy that. Today, it's the opposite. It is the domain of the masses. And I like going into the what's it called? The Apollo Gallery? Isn't that where all the regalia is? The crowns and the scepters and the orbs?
Yes, and I think you even told me that the Apollo Gallery was one of your favorite places in the Louvre, because at the entrance of the Apollo Gallery, it is announced this is a people's palace. But the Apollo Gallery was sort of the precursor to Versailles. I tell people, if they don't have enough time to go to Versailles, just go to the Apollo Gallery and you've got a mini Versailles, you know, started by Louis XIV, and it contains the crown jewels. But I have to tell you something. One of the things I discovered in doing my reporting on the Apollo Gallery is there are very few crown jewels in the Apollo Gallery. So I asked the question, where the heck are the crown jewels? And I discovered that in the Third Republic, there was such an anti-monarchical feeling that they had a grand auction at the Louvre and auctioned off most of the crown jewels, and Charles Tiffany bought a third of them. So wow. That there are very few French crown jewels, unlike Britain or even Iran.
When you think of the big picture of the sweep of art through Paris, it is interesting that the collection of the Louvre kind of stops in the middle of the 1800s, and then the story is picked up a little bit down the river at the Orsay Gallery, right?
Yes.
But in the Louvre, if you were to say what it is, it's art from before Christ times, from ancient Greek times and before, Mesopotamian times or whatever, all the way up till 1848 or so.
Yes.
Why does it cut off at 1848?
Well, there was just too much art. Uh-huh. And so they had to spread it around. So the Louvre, unlike the Metropolitan Museum in New York, for example, is not an encyclopedic museum. You can't get a sense of the grand sweep of all of art by going just to the Louvre. As you said, it ends in 1848. And so then you've got to go to the Orsay Museum across the river. And then if you want to go see modern art, you have to go to the Pompidou. This is a real investment of time and energy for a normal kind of American visitor, certainly, but any kind of a visitor.
But that's a very good tip, is if you want to trace the sweep of art history in Paris, you do have those three museums. The Louvre gets you up until the middle of the 1800s. The Orsay takes you the next 100 years or so. And then the modern contemporary art would be at the Pompidou. Elaine Chelino is helping us find new ways to enjoy the massive Louvre Museum in Paris right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She writes about its allure, romance, and even its secrets in her book, Adventures in the Louvre. Elaine's previous books include The Seine, The River That Made Paris, La Seduction, How the French Play the Game of Life, and The Only Street in Paris, about her neighborhood around the Rue des Martyrs. The French government has awarded Elaine a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor for contributing to the friendship between France and the United States. A fun part of your book, Elaine, was when you talked about the different types of visitors. Well, let me just let you review three or four of the different kinds of visitors to the Louvre.
Well, how do you make the Louvre yours? And one of the things I say in the book is choose your Louvre identity. Give yourself an identity. Are you a marathoner? Do you have to see everything? I mean, I interviewed people who have gone to see every single room and every single vitrine, every single glass case in the entire museum. It takes over a year to do that. Or you can be the sprinter. You can say, okay, I have 20 minutes and I'm going to see the big three, the Mona Lisa, the Venus de Milo, and the Winged Victory of Samothrace or Nike. And you can then rush out and you can say, okay, I've done it. I've seen the best of the best. And that's true. Or you can be like Umberto Eco, the Italian writer, a minimalist, and go into the Louvre and just go and see one work and sit in front of one work for an hour.
Yeah, I remember you wrote Umberto Eco, who you just got to love. You quoted him, I think he said, a half hour of intense contemplation enjoying a single statue or painting satisfies the spirit.
Well, exactly. And the way to do that, if you really want to know and understand the Louvre as a visitor, what I tell people, my dirty little secret is, you and your partner of whatever, spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, invest 120 euros and become a member of the French Friends of the Louvre, the Société des Amis du Louvre. And for 120 euros, you can get a pass, a year-long pass, that will give you any access in and out with no waiting in line, with no reservation, any time. And it is a golden pass, and it's a golden idea. And to wave that little card and to just cut the line and go in as if you are the director of the Louvre or a visiting royalty is something else. So that you don't feel like you don't feel like you have to see everything. You can literally go in for a half an hour, leave, come back.
Well, you're not really like the director of the Louvre, because that would be what you call the eternal explorer. And that was Henri Lorette, who lived in the Louvre. I didn't know possible.
He lived in the Louvre. But that's how much he wanted to get to know. But you know what? Even Henri Lorette said to me, I said to him, so Henri, after all these years, do you know the Louvre? And he said, you have to come to the Louvre with great humility, that it would be pretentious to say that you know the entire Louvre.
Amen. Hey, you've written a book, and the subtitle, as we mentioned, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. I'd love to know, just to cap this little love fest on the Louvre, where's your favorite personal spot? Where do you find the most joy?
Oh, that's a tough one. This is going to sound weird.
Maybe not the spot, but a place that a lot of us tourists might appreciate.
I have a favorite place of contemplation, but it may not be for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's sitting in the ground floor underneath the Islam collection on a banquette, on a bench in the back. And it's dark, and all you see is the light on various works of art. And what I love is the quiet and being in this extraordinary place where you can just be surrounded by beauty, but feel quiet and contemplation and meditation.
You know, I would say, Elaine, that the typical tourist experiences only crowds and shuffling in the museum, and that's their fault. And three-quarters of that museum is quiet, tranquility, and being surrounded by art almost all alone. And if you can venture to some of those distant corners of the Louvre, it's still great art. It's always, Lou Gehrig in the shadow of Babe Ruth, when you got the Mona Lisa getting all the attention. So find yourself in those beautiful, quiet corners and surround yourself with art made by painters whose names you don't even know.
100%. Exactly. Wonderful. Give yourself the freedom to get lost.
Elaine Chelino, thanks for joining. It's always good to talk with you about your love of Paris and appreciation of great culture and high art. And you've written a book about the pinnacle of high art, Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. I hope to see you there.
Inshallah, I'm there.
All right. Elaine Chelino's book, Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum, will be released April 1st. Elaine also has in-person appearances scheduled through May in the greater New York and Boston areas, plus Philadelphia, Atlanta, the San Francisco Bay Area, and in her hometown of Buffalo. Details are with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. By the way, they've just announced plans to renovate the museum's entrances by 2031 and to display the Mona Lisa in her own room to better organize the mad rush to see her. Find uncrowded discoveries in the Balkans. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves.